The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We have a lot to get to on today's program. There's going to be a strong educational theme on today's show as we look at some important history and also, I think, some very educational and informative sound bites. Later on in the program, we're going to talk about the Declaration of Independence. We're coming up on the Independence Day celebration in the United States. That's tomorrow, and more Americans, they really have no understanding or idea of what went into that document, what led up to it, or why they even celebrate the 4th of July holiday. We'll look back at some presidents of old and some of the things that they said, and also things that my father's brought out on his program, The Key of David, over the years. But before we get to that history, I just want to start today's show by referring back to a clip that we played yesterday. It was the one by Winston Churchill following the Second World War. And he talked about how that he had been warning for years and years and years, but no one paid attention. There he was during the wilderness years, sounding the alarm, but Britain had gone to sleep. The entire Western world had gone to sleep. He said in that soundbite I played yesterday that there never was a war in history easier to prevent by timely action than the one which had just desolated such great areas of the globe. I mean, it all could have been so easily prevented if someone would have just stepped forward and provided some timely action. And I went through that with you yesterday. Action for today. I mean, this is what action we need to take right now. Churchill believed that nightmare, all of those atrocities, he believed it could have been prevented without even firing a single shot. If there would have just been some courageous leaders who were willing to stand up to Adolf Hitler in the mid-1930s, all of it could have been prevented. Well, as he went on to say, we've got to make sure that we don't let this history repeat itself, that we don't let it happen again. That was what Churchill said back in 1946. Just a few weeks ago, this happened on May 17th, Oxford Union, they had this debate. The House, it says, believing that Britain should be ashamed of Churchill. So they had people representing both camps. The opposition arguing that Britain should not be ashamed of this man. But the reason I guess it came to our attention today is that the debates were just published yesterday on YouTube. And the opposition won, thankfully. Thankfully, this motion was defeated. And maybe that's why it didn't get so much attention. I'm sure it would have gotten more attention had this motion gone through. But even still, you had those that were arguing for looking upon Churchill, Winston Churchill, with shame, saying that Churchill he was one who enslaved people. He was one who was a proponent of forced famine. There was one speaker at this debate who pretty much said he was just as bad as Hitler, Winston Churchill. I mean, you take Churchill's views toward the Indians, and it's no different than Hitler's toward the Jews. That's what they said at this debate. Professor John Charmley, where does he teach? History of... He teaches history. He's a professor at history at the University of East Anglia. And he's also the author of a, a book titled Churchill, The End of Glory. And this is what Mr. Charmley, Professor Charmley, had to say at this debate. Here's clip 8.
Well, there was lots of freedom as long as you were white. There was not a lot of freedom if you were not. I don't know how many Africans or Indians voted to be members of the British Empire. So we had a war for democracy as long as you were white. Is that not something that we now have the moral courage to be ashamed of? Yes, it is. It was wrong.
And so there's one who's all for this movement that, well, we should be ashamed of Churchill because the fight for democracy, it was only for white people. He despises that history, the history of empire, and all the good that the British Empire took to all of the world, establishing outposts all around the world, establishing law and order, educational systems, systems of jurisprudence, roads, the infrastructure. I mean, you just can go on and on and on. We've brought this up on the program before. It's not to say that there weren't ever mistakes. But this is, as my father has explained, I mean, this was the closest. This was the closest mankind got to the kingdom of God. God is going to establish his kingdom on this earth, his empire. And of course, then it will be a perfect government in every respect. But with respect to Churchill, I mean, yes, he was pro-empire. He was a man of empire. But he saved Britain. And these critics, well, they like to talk about freedom and liberty, but they despise the people that made all of that possible. And you see the same thing in the United States. Freedom, liberty. There might be quite a few people celebrating in the United States tomorrow on July 4th. That can talk about freedom and liberty, but who know very little about those who fought for it and even died for it and sacrificed everything for it. That's what Winston Churchill did as he was sounding the alarm there during the 1930s, saying that no one's acting. No one has the courage to act. No one will stand up to Hitler. That's what was needed. Here's, again, Professor John Charmley at the Oxford Union debate from the month of May, May 17th, clip 9.
I take nothing away from Churchill's achievement then. I simply add to it that we have here a man who, whilst defending democracy in this country and in the West, denied it to huge swathes of the world.
That's well received by particularly quite a few young people coming up through the university ranks in the UK. We've got to get rid of that history. We've got to tear down the statues. We know so much more. We've progressed so much more. I mean, this is an enlightened time we're living in. And Churchill, I mean, what a throwback. What a racist. Look at the freedom that he denied to all of these nations around the world. That's what they say. And then, as I say, I mean, the motion did not pass, thankfully, but as Sam was noting this morning, I mean, he went through a lot of the videos. But even just the defense of Churchill, it could have been so much stronger. You were just listening to some of these individuals. One of them we'll play here for you in a second, Sir Nicholas Soames. He's an MP. He's the grandson of Winston Churchill. And it was pretty amazing just watching the video because he looked like his grandfather. But it could have been so much stronger, the defense of Winston Churchill, in this Manchester book that we've been reading. I forget when the first two volumes, I think those were written in maybe the 1980s. And then he didn't have time to finish volume 3, so he got help from someone else that was helping him do research after Manchester died. I forget the name of the other author that helped him put together Volume 3. But just in reading the first and second volume and the spirit behind it and the positive view of history, as my father has commented before, that comes through in Manchester's account. But not so much today. I mean, things have changed so much even since the 1980s. You can find a good biography from the 1980s. Well, I don't want to say it was just horrible. Here is Nicholas Soames, the MP. This is Winston Churchill's grandson. And here's what he said in defense of his grandfather's memory. This is clip 10.
We seem, Mr. President, very easily to forget that without Churchill's stand against fascism and the Nazis in the 1940s, it is questionable whether democracy would have survived on this side of the Atlantic at all. And the diversity and rights that we now celebrate and enjoy today might simply not exist. It is certainly clear beyond any shadow of doubt that this country would have been a very different place.
I mean, at best, it would have been very different. But the worst case scenario, and this seems a lot more likely, wouldn't you think? Hitler rolling through Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and then on through Scandinavia, and then Belgium, and then Holland, and then Luxembourg, and then France. He was coming for Britain, too. He wanted to bomb Britain off the map. All through the summer of 1940. We forget this. We can't forget. That's what Churchill said in that speech from 1946. We can't ever forget this history. We can't let this happen again. And here is his grandson in the month of May, a month or so ago, saying that, look, his stand against fascism and the Nazis in the 1940s, were it not for this, democracy wouldn't have survived on our island. Here's what the grandson had to say again in that May debate, clip 11.
Of course, inevitably, Churchill made many mistakes in a two-thirds of a century life in the public eye. But this current assault against Churchill and his position is, in my view, becoming hysterical, historically inaccurate, and in all too many cases, intellectually fraudulent.
That's Winston Churchill's grandson talking about how hysterical the criticism is today. But even in the defense of it, yes, and everyone always has to qualify, yes, he made his mistakes. Yes, there are lots of things that should have, judging by today's standards, that should have been done a lot differently. But, I mean, are today's standards really so much better than they were back in the 1940s? Our definition today of what's good and what's evil, it's farther removed from the Bible. We're going to talk more about that in the next segment. These founding documents of the United States, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution, grounded in biblical principles. How many people understand that today? One final clip here from Sir Nicholas Soames, the MP, and also the grandson of Winston Churchill. This is clip 12.
At the end of the war, Isaiah Berlin, possibly our greatest philosopher, said of this of Churchill, a man larger than life, composed of bigger and simpler elements than ordinary men, a gigantic historical figure during his own lifetime, superhumanly bold, strong and imaginative, one of the two greatest men of action his nation has produced, an orator of prodigious powers, the savior of his country, a mythical hero who belongs to legend as much as to reality.
That's Sir Winston Churchill's grandson defending his reputation at this Oxford Union debate from May of this year on whether or not we should be ashamed of Winston Churchill. It made me think, my father writes about this in our Churchill booklet, it made me think of that 1933 Oxford Union motion This is right as Hitler's coming into power, and Oxford Union, they had a debate on whether or not they would fight for country and king. This house will in no circumstances fight for its king and country. That was the motion. And did you know that it passed? I forget the exact figure. Oh, here it is in the quote. 275 to 153. Almost 2-1. They passed it in favor of, under no circumstances will we fight for king and country. That was Oxford in 1933. And it wasn't just Oxford. That was London. That was Whitehall. That was the government of the UK all through the 1930s. That was practically everyone but Churchill. You know how Churchill reacted to that Oxford Union motion back in 1933? He said, "That abject, squalid, shameless avowal was made last week by 275 votes to 153 in the debating society of our most famous university. We are told we ought not to treat it seriously." That's what we're told. Well, come on, it's just the university. They're just young people. Come on, let them have their debates. Even if they're wild and crazy, even if they're a little bit wacky. Churchill said, "The Times talks of the children's hour. I disagree. It is very disquieting and disgusting. It's a disquieting and disgusting symptom." He went on to explain. He explained why it was so troubling. Churchill said, "My mind turns across the narrow waters of the Channel and the North Sea, where great nations stand determined to defend their national glories or national existence with their lives. I think of Germany, with its splendid ancient songs, demanding to be conscripted into an army, eagerly seeking the most terrible weapons of war, burning to suffer and die for their fatherland." Churchill said, "One can almost feel the curl of contempt upon the lips of the manhood of all these peoples when they read this message sent out by Oxford University in the name of young England." Okay, you want to look back on your history and despise your own nation, your own empire? You want to put forward a motion and say, "This house will in no circumstances fight for its king and country"? All right then, but what about other nations? What about other rising or emerging powers? What about those nations that are competing with our homeland? Enemies of the homeland, with young people, tens of thousands, millions in some cases, who are more than willing to fight for king and country. Boy, you look at some of those speeches and writings of Winston Churchill during the 1930s. I mean, that's what saved his career. When Britain finally awakened during their darkest hour, Manchester brought this out in volume 2. He talked about how that when the war was declared in September of 1939, after Germany swept through Poland, that following that, it was pretty quiet for several months, even though Britain and France were technically at war. There wasn't a lot of action. There was some action out on the sea. But it wasn't until the spring, when the Nazis were marching in Scandinavia, Norway in particular, and Britain found out right away that its once powerful navy, I mean, it was going to be held in check more by the advent of air power, which changed things dramatically between the two world wars. In any event, it was a disaster for Britain in Norway. I think it was April or early May of 1940. And Churchill, when He wrote about this later, following the war. He talked about the events of late April 1940 and early May when Britain tried to push back against the Germans in Norway, and it was a big flop. And Churchill said, failure at Trondheim, that's a city in the middle of the nation, stalemate at Narvik, such in the first week of May were the only results we could show to the British nation, to our allies, and to the neutral world, friendly or hostile. Considering the prominent part I played, he was the first Lord of the Admiralty at that time, working underneath Chamberlain. He was in Chamberlain's government. And Churchill said, considering the prominent part I played in these events, it's a marvel that I survived. But he survived. I mean, once the German troops then started marching on Belgium and the Netherlands, then all of Britain, I mean, they were certain at that point, look, we've got to have Churchill. We can't continue on. I mean, they were really coming to that realization days before Churchill marched against those Low Countries. I think it was on May 10th of 1940. But as Churchill acknowledged later, it was really the fact that he had been writing about this, that he had been warning about this for 6 or 7 years. And finally, when people woke up, they knew that he was right. His wife, Churchill's wife, Clementine, she said, had it not been for your years of exile and repeated warnings regarding the German peril, Norway might well have ruined you. So there were more mistakes, and some of those mistakes were coming upon Churchill's shoulders as First Lord of the Admiralty. But as his wife said, had it not been for those years in exile when you were sounding the alarm, it just makes you think of Ezekiel 33 and verse 33. Of course, those first few verses in chapter 33 are about Churchill, the watchman. He was a prophet in many ways. And it says in verse 33, of course, this is about an end time watchman, but still, it says in Ezekiel 33 and verse 33, and when this comes to pass, lo, it will come, then shall they know that a prophet has been among them. I mean, once the events are upon us, all of these events that were prophesied, then they're going to know, well, there was one individual who was proclaiming the truth. As bad as it was for Churchill in the 1930s, as bad as it was for him personally, all of those messages, those strong warnings, that sounding of the alarm, I mean, all of that came back to actually reinforce his position, to strengthen his position in May of 1940, when he finally did become Britain's prime minister and saved the people of Britain from tyranny. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Perhaps no hour in Britain's history was darker than that preceding World War II. Nazi Germany was arming. Nations in Europe were being conquered, their borders redrawn. Britain, the nation that once ruled one quarter of the earth, teetered on the edge of survival. Many leaders in Britain feared war. They wanted to disarm. They spoke of peace as Europe sank deeper into the pit of war. This dark hour may have been Britain's last, were it not for one man. This man stood alone in the face of adversity at home and abroad. He rose to the occasion when his nation needed him most. He vowed that Britain would never surrender when confronted by forces of evil. Winston Churchill took Britain's most important job during Britain's darkest hour. He did what others were afraid to do. Some doubted his methods, but the results speak for themselves. Churchill led Britain from the precipice of ignominious defeat and possible death to what became one of the nation's brightest hours. What was it that made Winston Churchill so different from other leaders of his time? Surely now, more than ever, this world needs another Winston Churchill. Our booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, explains what made this man such a great leader. We would like to offer this booklet to you free of charge. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new gods for their future security.
That's President John F. Kennedy reciting the lines there from at least the opening lines there from the Declaration of Independence. The founders were, as they clearly spell out, it's not like we're saying just topple the government at the first sign of distress. But when there's this long train of abuses and usurpations, then in these circumstances, you've got to fight for the laws, the higher laws of nature and of nature's God. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. There are millions and millions of Americans who know precious little about the 4th of July, about the Declaration of Independence, about what happened in 1776. You see the videos every year at this time. Prager University, it produced one just the other day. You know, the guy that's at the university campus or out at the beach with his microphone and the camera walking up to these young people, saying, you know, when was the revolution? Who did we fight against? Who composed the documents? Or who were some of the signers for the Declaration of Independence? What year did it happen? And you have all of this ignorance, which really, if you consider the tone of these productions, even though they're coming from conservative organizations, it's just having fun with it. Having fun with ignorance. It does expose the ignorance to some degree. But I'm amazed even by some of the more conservative commentators who expose the ignorance at how much they just kind of laugh it off. They think it's a big joke that we don't know anything about our own history. I mean, the Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution, these are the foundational documents of not just the American nation, but really of the Anglo-dominated world of the past two centuries. Certainly the Magna Carta, which came along centuries before the United States did. You put the Magna Carta in there together with those documents. These are the foundational documents of the English-speaking world, the Anglo-dominated world. And in the case of America, as I said, our founders determined that a revolution was justified in the name of the higher laws of nature and of nature's God on July 2nd of 1776, the Continental Congress approved the resolution that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. And 2 days later, on July 4th, 1776, Congress approved the final draft of the Declaration of Independence. It was John Adams who, following all this, wrote to his wife and said that America's independence would be celebrated by succeeding generations as a great anniversary festival. He talked about how it would be celebrated with pomp and parade, with shows and games and sports and guns and bells and bonfires. It didn't happen right at first. In fact, it wasn't until 1870 that July 4th finally became an established national holiday, but John Adams was pretty much spot on. Today, it's a big celebration. But how many Americans even understand what they're celebrating? How many of them even know any of the history? Or how many of them look upon the history like some of those young people at Oxford Union look upon their own history during the Second World War? Or their own prime minister, Winston Churchill? How many of those conservative commentators that are out and about exposing the ignorance about July 4th, 1776, how many of them know the deep spiritual and biblical roots that are there connecting to these documents, these foundational documents? Thomas Jefferson, he's the one that wrote the Declaration. And he said his best ideas of democracy came from church meetings. I mean, these documents, these foundational documents, they're grounded in biblical principles. Calvin Coolidge, I'll quote from his, he gave an awesome speech back in 1926 to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, and he talked about the importance of the Bible, the importance the Bible had in the establishment of those documents. He talked about the importance of the Bible to our founding fathers. And then you look at, I just read a bit of it, you heard it from John F. Kennedy. Laws of nature and of nature's God. And then it talked about being created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. You look into the Bible where it says God is no respecter of persons, how that he gives to all men liberally, if we obey, of course, but we're judged fairly, equally. This is a concept, as I say, that flows out from the Word of God. And furthermore, everyone who's created equal is subject to the same law. There's no respect of persons in judgment either, Deuteronomy 1. And it says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. In other words, government exists to uphold and to enforce the law. It's observing these laws that secures these rights, these freedoms. But the law is what reigns supreme. I mean, without the law, you're just left with lawlessness. That's the worst kind of captivity there is. What is it that preserves the freedom? Well, it's the rule of law. And so this is why the founders said, look, with these kinds of documents, based upon these kinds of principles, without religion and morality, it's not going to work. It just won't work. And so these towering figures of American history, I mean, they were well familiar with John 8 and verse 32, how that the truth makes you free. 1 Peter 2 and verse 16, live as free men, yet without using your freedoms as a pretext for evil, but live as servants to God. See, the founders understood that if you use your freedom as a pretext for evil, everything breaks down. You have to live as servants to God, or everything breaks down. How prominently is religion placed in the foundation of the nation, the United States? John Adams said, we've given you this quote so many times before, it's religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand. Religion and morality alone. You have to have these two pillars, or otherwise people are going to come along and just use the freedom as a pretext for evil. And you see a lot of that happening today. The speech that Calvin Coolidge gave back in 1926, it's an amazing speech. I wish there was a recording of it. It was probably just a little bit too early for that. But in 1926, he said the American Revolution represented the informed and mature convictions of a great mass of independent, liberty-loving, God-fearing people who knew their rights and possessed the courage to dare to maintain them. Coolidge said, when we take all these circumstances into consideration, it is but natural that the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence should open with a reference to nature's God, and should close in the final paragraph with an appeal to the supreme judge of the world and an assertion of a firm reliance on divine providence. This is a president of the United States just pointing out all of the references to the great creator God in America's own Declaration of Independence. Coolidge said, coming from these sources, having as it did this background, it's no wonder that Samuel Adams could say the people seem to recognize this resolution as though it were a decree promulgated from heaven. That's how we recognized it in 1776. That's why these framers risked their lives, because they saw it as a decree from heaven. Coolidge says, no one can examine this record and escape the conclusion that in the great outline of its principles, the Declaration was the result of the religious teachings of the preceding period. If you conduct an honest study, you cannot escape the conclusion that this was the result of religious teaching, theology. It says they are found in the texts, the sermons, and the writings of the early colonial clergy who were earnestly undertaking to instruct their congregations in the great mystery of how to live. See, it's like Thomas Jefferson said, the best ideas of democracy, they come out of church meetings. Coolidge said they preached equality because they believed in the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. They justified freedom by the text that we are all created in the divine image, all partakers of the divine spirit. While scantily provided with it, with other literature, there was a wide acquaintance with the scriptures. See, going back to that time, I mean, people were more familiar with the scriptures than they were other literature. Over a period as great as that which measures the existence of our independence, they were subject to this discipline, not only in their religious life and educational training, but also in their political thought. They were a people who came under the influence of a great spiritual development and acquired a great moral power. This is quite a speech. Could you imagine a president of the United States giving a speech like this today? Look at how far removed we are from God and just from the simple truths of the Bible. The basic truths, the fundamental truths, the self-evident truths. Coolidge says here, no other theory is adequate to explain or comprehend the Declaration of Independence. It is the product of the spiritual insight of the people. We live in an age of science and of abounding accumulation of material things. These did not create our Declaration. Our Declaration created them. He says, the things of the Spirit come first. This is pretty deep. There's some real depth here. I mean, we've got to get the priorities straight. What comes first? It's God who's first. It's God who's given us these blessings. It's God who gave us the Declaration. He said, unless we cling to that, all our material prosperity, overwhelming though it may appear, will turn to a barren scepter in our grasp. Unless we cling to this, we are going to lose it all. That's what he's saying. If we are to maintain the great heritage which has been bequeathed to us, we must be like-minded as the fathers who created it. I mean, we've got to be like the founders. We better think and reason like the founders did. We must not sink into pagan materialism. We must cultivate the reverence which they had for things that are holy. Yes, indeed, we've got to be a morally upright people. We've got to be a religious and morally upright people. We've got to be a people subject to the law of the land. My father gave a program in 2011. Destroying the Constitution, and he's talking here in this clip about what British historian Paul Johnson had to say. It's a quote we have also in our booklet, No Law Without Order, or No Freedom Without Law, I think it is. In any event, here's what my father said in that 2011 program, clip two.
And so here's what Paul Johnson wrote, both in Virginia and in New England. To the north, the colonists were determined, God-fearing men, Mr. Johnson wrote, often in search of a religious toleration denied them at home, who brought their families and were anxious to farm and establish permanent settlements. They put political and religious freedom before riches, thus took shape the economic dynamo that eventually became the United States, an experiment designed to establish the rule of God on earth. Now, that was the experiment. They wanted to establish the rule of God on this earth. That's how it all began. Now, that is a far, far cry from the way we're doing things today. Wouldn't you agree? Wouldn't you agree with that? I mean, think about that. I mean, think about that. There's no other nation that ever began like that, that they wanted to establish the rule of God on this earth in America. Wow. Now that is impressive. And of course, it would be based on the Ten Commandments and the Bible. That's what they were talking about.
That's where they got their beliefs, from the Bible. That's how they were going to establish the rule of law. They looked into the Bible. They looked into the Old Testament. And they saw the kingdom of Israel, where its kings were subject to the supreme law. And so the law applies to everyone. And again, to reiterate what John Adams said, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. I mean, that's what holds everything together. We've got to be lawful. We've got to be obedient. There is no freedom without law. Coming back to that Calvin Coolidge speech from 1926, he said, amid all the clash of conflicting interests, amid all the welter of partisan politics, every American can turn for solace and consolation to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the U.S. with the assurance and confidence that those two great charters of freedom and justice remain firm and unshaken. Whatever perils appear, whatever dangers threaten, the nation remains secure in the knowledge that the ultimate application of the law of the land will provide an adequate defense and protection. See, you can always fall back on these pillars. But what happens when we turn to lawlessness? What happens when it's every man doing what seems right in his own eyes? What happens when everyone has a different interpretation of what the law says? Well, then you've got half the country that says this judge would be great and this one would be terrible, and the other half says just the opposite. Coolidge, just to conclude here, he says, it is often asserted that the world has made a great deal of progress since 1776, that we have had new thoughts and new experiences which have given us a great advance over the people of that day, and that we may therefore very well discard their conclusions for something more modern. It's just like with Churchill, you see. Oh, we're so much more modern and sophisticated today. We know so much more than Churchill. We know so much more than the founders. Coolidge says, but that reasoning cannot be applied to this great charter. If all men are created equal, that is final. If they are endowed with inalienable rights, that is final. If governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, that is final. No advance, no progress can be made beyond these propositions. If anyone wishes to deny their truth or their soundness, the only direction in which he can proceed historically is not forward, but backward. Backward toward the time when there was no equality, no rights of the individual, no rule of the people. We think we're making progress. In fact, we're going backwards. My father gave one, this was more recent actually, this program from March of this year, The Bible and the Constitution. Here's what he had to say, clip 3.
And the Constitution became the foundation of this very republic. And the founding fathers, as I said, gave up streams of blood, their own blood, to give us this document. Many of them died not even being able to be a part of it so that we might have this document. They gave it to us, gave their blood to give it to us.
They sacrificed everything. You look at that declaration, the final sentence. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. How thankful on this July 4th holiday for Americans, we should ask, how thankful are we for those who went before, for those who sacrificed all? How aware are we of these tremendous sacrifices, these life-altering sacrifices? One of my favorite Paul Harvey commentaries, it's from way back in July of 1974. This goes back a number of years. But this is a speech he gave where, and it played on the radio. I think initially it was a column. He wrote this. But then in his very distinctive voice, he gave us an oral reading of it as well. And in this speech, he talked about the sacrifices that the founders made. And just to set up that point about the sacrifice, the mutual pledge, here's what he said early on in the commentary, clip four.
In the Pennsylvania State House that's now called Independence Hall in Philadelphia, the best men from each of the colonies sat down together. This was a very fortunate hour in our nation's history, one of those rare occasions in the lives of men when we had greatness to spare. These were men of means, well-educated, 24 were lawyers and jurists, 9 were farmers, owners of large plantations. On June 11, a committee sat down to draw up a Declaration of Independence. We were going to tell the British fatherland, no more rule by redcoats. Below the dam of ruthless foreign rule, the stream of freedom was running shallow and muddy. And we were going to light a fuse to dynamite that dam. This pact, as Burke later put it, was a partnership between the living and the dead and the yet unborn.
So it was a pact that those framers made. And these were men of means, as he goes on to explain, men who sacrificed all for us. Clip 5.
Jefferson finished a draft of the document in 17 days. Congress adopted it in July, and so much is familiar history. But now, King George III had denounced all rebels in America as traitors. Punishment for treason was hanging. The names now so familiar to you from the several signatures on that Declaration of Independence. The names were kept secret for 6 months, for each knew the full meaning of that magnificent last paragraph in which his signature pledged his life, his fortune, and his sacred honor. 56 men placed their names beneath that pledge. 56 men knew when they signed that they were risking everything. They knew if they won this fight, the best they could expect would be years of hardship in a struggling nation. And if they lost, they'd face a hangman's rope.
56 men counted the cost. They knew that upon signing this document, they were risking everything. At worst, a hangman's rope, as he said there, but even at best, years and years of hardship and struggle to get the nation established. And Mr. Harvey goes on to talk about the many sacrifices made. Clip 6.
Of the 56, few were long to survive. 5 were captured by the British and tortured before they died. 12 had their homes from Rhode Island to Charleston sacked, looted, occupied by the enemy, or burned. 2 lost their sons in the army. 1 had 2 sons captured. 9 of the 56 died in the war from its hardships or from its more merciful bullets.
And so when you see these videos from the university campuses of today or from the beaches or from the parades on July 4th, and people have no knowledge of what happened, when it happened, who the United States was battling against, what we were fighting for, it's more than sad. It's tragic. What happens when you forget your history? Or when you revise your history, when you say something that was glorious is now something that's evil and shameful. Well, God says, and of course the lesson of history says the same thing, that if we forget this past, if we erase this past, we're going to make the same mistakes. Think about these sacrifices. For those of you in America in particular, coming up to this July 4th celebration, all of these founders, 56 signers, some of them making the ultimate sacrifice, lost their property, lost their possessions, and they did it for freedom. They did it for the establishment of this law, the Declaration, and the later on the Constitution of the United States of America. I want to conclude today's program with the conclusion from that Paul Harvey commentary from 1974. Here's clip 7.
I don't know what impression you had of the men who met that summer in Philadelphia, but I think it's important that we remember this about them. They were not poor men. They were not wild-eyed pirates. These were men of means. They were rich men, most of them, and had enjoyed much ease and luxury in their personal living. Not hungry men, certainly not terrorists, not irresponsible malcontents, not fanatical incendiaries. These men were prosperous men, wealthy landowners. They were substantially secure in their prosperity. They had everything to lose. But they considered liberty, and this is as much as I shall say of it, they had learned that liberty is so much more important than security, that they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And they fulfilled their pledge. They paid the price. And freedom was born.